Hi there, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0, and this time I'm introducing a new kind of zoomed out episode that I'm calling Subgenre Spotlight. And since COVID-19 isn't very far in the rearview mirror, if at all, I thought maybe we could start with pandemic fiction. And right here, I do want to issue a trigger warning for anybody who has lost loved ones or experienced trauma through the pandemic. Maybe this isn't the type of thing you want to listen to right now. I don't think we're going to be too morbid in this episode, but you know, you never know. So yeah, just wanted to put that out there. We'll try to be careful during the discussion to not cause any further pain. That said, I am delighted to be joined by Bob Marl for this discussion. Hi there, Bob.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And we've been corresponding over email for, I don't know, a few months, I think, since I started planning these kind of things. So how about a little bit of your bio and background?
All right. Well, I also want to say I really enjoyed this podcast. I think your Hugo nomination is well-deserved.
Oh, thank you.
But I guess I could start by giving away a little bit about my age. I'm a child of the Sputnik panic. Back when the Soviets were, not the Russians, were ahead of us, and everybody thought we had fallen behind on science, and so they just started pushing it, everything they could in the schools, and I just ate it up. I love science. I still follow science the way a lot of people follow sports. And that led me into science fiction, which is a good way to get advanced science that they won't give you in elementary school. But I really got interested in science fiction for science fiction's sake when I read 2001 Space Odyssey, which I actually read while Apollo 11 was heading to the moon.
Oh, cool.
Sort of the end of space travel science fiction, actually, for a little while. But from there, I got more interested in the literary, you know, Zelazny and Le Guin. And right out of college, I started writing science fiction. I managed to publish two novellas and two short stories. And then one of the publishers started a literary agency and asked to be my agent. So I quickly and very poorly wrote a novel, which unfortunately for me was predicated on the Soviet Union being the dominant world power, which is a very, very bad premise to have in the late 80s.
Yes. The real world kind of intervened to make that not work. Yeah, well, it just pushed it into alternate history, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, in fact, that's sort of what we're going to be talking about today, because COVID is sort of messing with other people's history that they put into their pandemic fiction.
Yeah.
But my daytime job while I was trying to write was in a clinical microbiology lab in a large medical center. And so I think listeners need to be warned right off the bat, I am not an MD or a PhD. My microbiology experience is in the trenches, the very dirty, smelly trenches. I started, though, in the late 70s, which put me right in time for the AIDS pandemic. And that just totally changed microbiology, how we did it and what it was. Then after the Soviet Union fell and my agent returned my novel.
Meaning he dropped it?
I went back to grad. Yes, he dropped it. And I went back to grad school. But science fiction had to help me one way. I had gotten one of the very first IBM PCs to do word processing. And DOS 1.0. So that is what passed for computer experience back then. And that started leading me into a computerized microbiology a little bit, infection control, computing, and clinical research informatics, which is just a fancy way of saying I was a computer nerd. So in a way, I sort of owe my career to science fiction. In 1998, the Cancer Center recruited me to run their research databases. So another warning to listeners, my microbiology knowledge is also outdated. With those warnings, though, a couple of years after that, I rediscovered audiobooks, which got me back into science fiction and reading in general. As I neared retirement, I began writing again, and I've written two novels, one of which I think is good enough to publish, but you know, my agent's long dead, so I'll have to endure the slush piles for a while, I guess. So right now, my focus is on humorous science fiction. I just think laughter is the highest form of literature. Mm. Maybe that's just because I find the rest of the world so depressing. I don't know.
Yeah.
So being retired, though, I'll say in reference to COVID, it was not very challenging for me, unless right. you count being part of the target demographic that could get killed. But really, I'm the husband of a retired librarian. Mm. So we just enjoy nothing more than staying at home with the cats and reading books. Right. So, you know, if pandemic was right up my alley. Mm-hmm. It also got me back into reading microbiology. And I still... And
through your career, you were used to wearing masks and taking precautions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Boy, nobody knew how to wear a mask better than me, and nobody knew how to wash their hands better than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even with all the reading and stuff, I still underestimated the virus, mainly because SARS had been so self-limiting in 2002. That was SARS-1.
Yeah.
So there's another lesson for you. Even with professional experience and full access to a medical school library, you can still go down the wrong path. Mm-hmm. It did actually, my hospital contacts did get me into the Moderna COVID vaccine trial.
Oh, so you got vaccines earlier than other folks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I originally got the placebo, but eventually they figured out it worked and they called me in early and gave me the real thing. Mm. So that was kind of interesting to watch, because I'd been working in clinical trials before in the cancer center, and to see it operate at just a hyper velocity that they operate in was just very fascinating. In terms of what you like to know, I have read 43 Hugo winners.
Nice.
I may be more, but when you've been reading it for 60 years, you sort of forget some of them. I was trying to look at some of the summaries, and I go, God, that really sounds familiar, but I'm just not sure if I've read that. My favorite books are Lord of Light and The Left Hand of Darkness, Year Zero, Doorways in the Sand, Good Omens, and Practically Anything by Terry Pratchett.
Nice.
Like I said, I'm into humor.
So. Right. Now, you had mentioned earlier that you spent your time in the trenches, and in our talking, as we've been planning, you mentioned a couple stories. I do think it's worth mentioning, right, how scary AIDS was, because here it comes along, and everybody who gets it dies, and we don't know what it is, right?
Right. It was very scary. But I'll tell you a story. It is part AIDS and part tells you about being in the trenches. Mm-hmm. So near the end of my time in microbiology, I was working mostly on computers, but I still had this job of evaluating new tests for the lab to use. And mm-hmm. when I say tests, I'm not talking about drop and wait for two lines to appear.
Right.
I'm talking about with test tubes and pipettes and machines and all that stuff. And one of the things that we were working on was AIDS patients would get this horrible intestinal illness. I can't remember if it was Cryptosporidium or Mycobacterium avium, but some company came in with a PCR test, one of the early PCR tests. Mm. And they said, okay, Bob, you know, let's figure out if this thing works. Well, that meant that I had to collect a bunch of AIDS diarrhea, bloody AIDS diarrhea. So I get these little tubs and I'd stick them in a freezer. And when I got the freezer full, I was going to test it. And I just was not looking forward to that.
Yeah.
As you might imagine. And finally, one day my boss came in and said, I think you need to pull out all that poop. I don't think he actually said that. and thaw it out and test them all. And I said, yeah, I guess it is time. And right about then, I got a phone call from the cancer center. They said, we'd like you to come work and manage our clinical trials databases and stuff like that. And I said, so that would be an office job and it'd be all computers. And they said, oh, yeah, you wouldn't be working in a lab. And I looked over at that freezer full of poop and I went, yeah, I'll take that job. So, yeah, that's trenches. And, you know, so, yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, kind of moving into that sort of suffices to the intro to Bob, but now kind of moving into the actual kind of subgenre discussion. One of the things that surprised me as we were emailing back and forth is that pandemic fiction is basically as old as science fiction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so that actually surprised me, too, when I was looking at it. Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein and everybody sort of calls her the mother of science fiction. She wrote a pandemic novel called The Last Man just 8 years after she wrote Frankenstein. Mm. And apparently she was late to the party. Between the time she wrote Frankenstein and the time she wrote The Last Man, other people had pretty much saturated the field with that kind of work. And I often wonder if maybe The Year Without a Summer, which was 1816, I think, that generated Frankenstein, maybe that triggered other people into writing about, you know, disaster fiction of that kind.
So getting into more specifics about the subgenre of pandemic fiction, are there different kinds of pandemic fiction? And maybe, like, if you have examples of any of those.
Oh, yeah. So, I'm sure there are bunches of different ways you could break them down. But I'm just going to pick based on how the pandemic is used in the story. And so, like, the first type, being a computer nerd, I'll call it type zero. In those kind of stories, the pandemic never happens. The suspense comes from the hero trying to prevent the disease from being either being released or spreading. You know, you might wipe out a town or two just to demonstrate the power of the thing, but the rest of the world escapes. Examples of that might be like the Andromeda strain and a very scientifically hard to swallow outbreak movie. Now there's one movie I got to mention. Probably nobody knows about it. It's a 60s movie called The Satan Bug. And it is, if you watch it now, it is campy and dated and it's horrible. But I saw it when I was a teenager, and this movie gave me nightmares back then. I don't know why. Because it's really ironic because 10 years later, I was working in a clinical microbiology lab with the pathogens. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Andromeda strain, right? That definitely has that where like a town gets wiped out and then the hero scientists come in and – well, actually, it's not even really through their work that the thing goes away. It just kind of goes up into the atmosphere.
Yeah, it mutates into a less pathogenic form, which I want to blame Andromeda strain for creating that kind of myth because, you know, bugs don't mutate. They don't care about us at all. They just care about whether they can replicate. And typically, when a virus seems to becoming less pathogenic, what it is we've all been exposed to it or been vaccinated, and it gets, and of course we don't react to it as strongly.
So, right. Yeah.
But once you get past, you know, these pandemics that never happen, there's, I think, what you want to call the prime or number one type of pandemic fiction, which is one that's centered entirely on the pandemic itself. And these are actually rare in science fiction. We'll get to the other type in a second, but I think the Doomsday Book by Connie Willis, that's a perfect example. You get two pandemics for the price of one in that book. Yeah. And then there's Contagion, which is probably the movie that got cited most often. And I thought that was the most scientifically accurate. I mean, it tied everything up in a ribbon. And that's the way Hollywood is, I guess. But more recently, we've had Ha High, We Can Go in the Dark, which I think most of that was written before the pandemic, was edited during the pandemic.
Yeah. And that's Sequoia Nagamatsu. That's one I really enjoyed.
Yeah. I had some problems. We can get into that later. But, you know, another example, there was some post-pandemic in that one. Also, there was a post-pandemic in World War Z, a zombie novel. You know, and all zombie novels are basically just epidemiology with monsters, you know, basically.
So, well, and World War Z succeeded, you know, it was a follow-on book from The Zombie Survival Guide by Max Brooks. Where in that one, he goes into talking about like the virology of it, the Solanum virus, I think he calls it, and, you know, why it drives the host to bite to pass on the virus and that kind of stuff.
I like that book. It was it was fun to read. But again, all that too had some post-pandemic scenes.
Yeah.
But then once you get past that, you get to the what is the most common pandemic novel. We'll call it type two, but it's just really what it is the pandemic is just a method for getting to a post-apocalyptic aftermath.
Right.
You know, you kill off everybody usually in the first few chapters or sometimes even the first few pages. Mm-hmm. And then everybody marches forward into a really grim, depopulated, simplified world. Mm-hmm. So a good example of that would be Station 11 mm-hmm. by Mendel. An older example of that, which is kind of interesting, is The Earth Abides.
Yeah.
That was written in 1948. And if you were on Audible early on before they tanked up their science fiction collection, that they pushed that one religiously. Mm. And I that's how I heard it.
Yeah, I just listened to that one last week.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little dated, mm-hmm. But what that was really about was the, everybody in 1948 was terrified of a nuclear Holocaust.
Right.
So this was a way of having a Holocaust, but all the buildings were still standing.
Yes.
And that sort of created the meme of a post-apocalyptic, post-pandemic novel that's basically just a large scavenger hunt, yeah. You know, trying to find toilet paper and mm-hmm. antibiotics. You don't have the radiation problems, et cetera.
Right. In that one, I mean, like the light stayed on for quite a while. The water faucets worked for a long time until the reservoir leaked and drained.
Yeah. I think COVID kind of nixed that concept because we saw things break down pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And that also, there's prepper fiction.
Yeah.
An example of that would be Odd Billy Todd. And they basically use pandemic and just about any kind of disaster to basically highlight how the preppers will survive.
Right.
And they seldom go too far because too many generations out, you know, suddenly if you don't have miners to mine iron, you don't get any more guns, et cetera, so forth.
Right.
Or solar panels. Sort of an example we'll have to talk about this sort of a break from all that is Scalzi's Lock-In, which is an exception to the kill almost everybody rule. And I think if you look at that one, it might point the way forward for future pandemic novels.
Yeah.
Those, I think we've covered almost all of the books that were covered. Although, yeah, the nonfiction Phoenix Economy, which I made you read.
Yeah. No, that was interesting too, because I think Lock-In has something in common with the Phoenix Economy, where the Phoenix Economy, you told me just at least listen to read the first chapter or mm-hmm. the introduction to it. And he talked about in that book, and this is Felix Salmon, I think is the name. Mm-hmm. About the fact that, you know, we had the luxury of COVID happening in the era of high bandwidth internet and, Zoom and things like that, right? So people could actually, not everyone, obviously, could shift to working from home, where if it had happened in, 1995, that's not going to work with dial-up internet mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And so there was a fortunate kind of coincidence of the rise of the high bandwidth and internet telephony and all that kind of stuff that was really helpful. And in Lock-In, I think there's technology that lets the people who are locked in still have a life. Mm-hmm.
Right. And which I think was what I was going to mention about that one is that's kind of parallels Zoom and other virtual technologies. It's kind of pushes that out there.
Yeah.
And one of the other things in the Phoenix Economy, he references a pandemic joke, which only Douglas Adams, he's referencing Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, only Douglas Adams could get away with a pandemic joke. But,
Right.
But we'll talk about that, I guess, when we get into some of the other details.
Yeah. Okay. So we've covered type 0, type 1, type 2. And then within a pandemic novel, what does the structure typically look like? What are the elements?
Yeah. So I was trying to tease this out, and I was reviewing summaries of books that I'd read a long time ago, one of which was World War Z, which we've already talked about. And I ran across the chapter headers for that book. And so I'm going to read them. They are Warnings, Blame, The Great Panic, Turning the Tide, Homefront USA, Around the World and Above, Total War, and Goodbyes.
Nice. Definitely the first few of those at least are quite recognizable from COVID. And you have some of that in Doomsday Book as well, especially the blame part. that was interesting in Doomsday Book that, you know, they called it like the Indian flu or something. And they're like, hey, let's blame this disease on brown people.
Right.
Whereas, you know, you had Trump constantly calling COVID the China virus, right? And I'm like, I mean, that sounds pretty racist to me.
We always get the origin wrong. I mean, the 1918 flu was called the Spanish flu.
Yeah.
But the only reason it was called that was because they were the only ones who weren't censoring the news. So everybody else was in the middle of World War One, and Spain was neutral. So they started talking about, hey, man, a lot of people are dropping dead. Yeah. And so they called it the Spanish flu, even though everybody knew it was happening everywhere else, too. So, So I think if you take those chapter headers, you can basically simplify it even further just to three parts. And I'd say the first part, which is actually my favorite part of any pandemic novel, and actually my favorite part of a lot of science fiction, is the first discovery and the growing awareness. There's looming danger and denial and secret knowledge and people starting to panic. In a way, it's like I said, it's very much like other science fiction, where something really big and unprecedented happens. Mm-hmm. And, an example would be a first contact novel. Mm. A first contact novel and a pandemic novel, basically, one has an epidemiologist with a microscope and the other has an astronomer with a telescope.
Right.
Both of them are seeing something they have never seen before, and they're starting to panic about it. So I went back trying to find an example of this in COVID, and I hit a good one. This is from a podcast called This Week in Virology.
Yeah.
And it's an old podcast, and it before COVID, it was just an obscure academic podcast where virologists reviewed papers and kind of let their hair down. And it had a very relaxed atmosphere and probably very small.
Yeah, you had compared it to Car Talk for virologists.
Yeah, it's like Car Talk for virologists, yeah. and they laugh a lot. Well, yeah, after COVID, it became very popular. A lot of people started listening to it.
Yeah.
But I went and I looked and I found where they first discussed COVID. They didn't even call it COVID because it didn't have a name yet.
Yeah, yeah. You sent me that episode.
Yes, episode 582, and it was in early January 2020. And they had all sorts of things. You could, when you listen to it, it just, I don't know. I listened to it and I got goosebumps, but that's just a retired microbiologist. But, there was a talk about the virology work in Hunan. There was discussion of the seafood market, and there was a lot of uncertainty over how contagious the disease was and how much it was spreading. I mean, listening to it, you get this kind of ominous foreshadowing since you know what's actually happened. It wasn't even mentioned until 14 minutes into the podcast.
Right.
And that gave it kind of that important story hidden in the mundane. I mean, in back in the days before podcasts, it would be, you open the newspaper and there on page 14, you'd see this little blurb about, some people are getting sick in China,
Right.
And that's very close to what you see in pandemic fiction, because the first chapters are all that kind of secret knowledge going on. But once that's over, you move on to the second part, which is the great mortality. And I have to say, in a lot of books, this is skipped or viewed retroactively. But most authors seem to like just throw really big numbers that are impossible to comprehend. Mm-hmm. I think they use the old Stalin trick, that one death is a tragedy, but millions are a statistic. Mm. But there are some books, and the one you liked, How High We Can Go in the Dark, and the Doomsday Book, they really force you to come to terms with individuals facing death.
Yeah.
I have to say, this was part of my experience with HIV, because my work made it impossible not to see patient suffering and loss. I even met families of survivors or families of victims. Whereas outside of medicine, a lot of my friends who were also outside the main risk groups, they just willfully ignored the disease.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you think back to AIDS and it kind of starting in a marginalized group, right? Politically, nobody was going to make a big deal about this, at least on the political right. Nobody was going to be like, this is an emergency. They're like, oh, well, it's affecting gay men. You know, screw those guys.
Although I do remember literally the Moral Majority had a magazine ad with a bunch of a heterosexual family all wearing masks. Of course, masks were completely unnecessary
for
AIDS. But, you know, I saw that and I think back on that now and I think about, they were like masks for the ones where it didn't help. they don't like masks otherwise.
Right.
So once you get past the great mortality, then the third part for the novels that have that part is, for the majority of pandemic novels, I would think, is it's really the goal, which is to get back to that simplified society we talked about. Now, sometimes some pandemics will do novels will do a kind of twist. And one of them that you mentioned, and I think I've seen it in other ones, is radical gender ratios, where one gender or the other is wiped out.
Yeah, like Y, the last man, right?
Yeah, where Y is not W-H-Y, it's Y chromosome.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think his name is, I can't remember what his name is now. I lost it. I had it. All I want to say is Yogesh, but that's somebody I work with. I can't remember what his name was, but his name begins with a Y. But yeah, in that one, it's anything with a Y chromosome is affected by this virus and wiped out. And so it threatens the end of humanity.
Yeah. There was an interesting thing in the summary you sent me about that. So in that novel, or it's a
graphic novel. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody dies on the same day, which is, I think it's Stephen King, maybe The Stand, I'm not sure, where the same thing happens, but unlike the Y last man in Stephen King came up with a scientific explanation for this, which was very creative, I thought. I give him points for at least trying to come up with an explanation for something, because it wasn't this long spreading event and terror. It was just like, boom, it's over.
Yeah. I mean, see how like some kind of engineered bioweapon could do something like that.
Yeah. I think that's what Stephen King did. He had a virus already out there, and then some.
There's a catalyst for
space.
It.
Yeah. A catalyst was from radiation from space or something catalyzed it, and everybody got it at once.
Yeah. I do want to mention, I'll put a link in the show notes to the This Week in Virology. You sent me a couple different episodes, because one where like they just kind of casually mention it, and then another one where they realize how bad it is.
Yes. I mean, you could hear them starting to get really worried. And I think the thing that they, there were several things that they had to confront. One was the possibility that it was, that they were asymptomatic cases. That was the thing that a lot of people missed.
Yeah.
And then they also were really upset when the testing totally failed and everybody was looking only at certain things instead of a broader picture. So it just was able to sneak in. But yeah, those were several good episodes to listen to.
So looking back at the kind of three steps, right? Like you mentioned earlier, a lot of this is common for any kind of apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic novel. I can say that word, where it's just different causes, right? It's biological in some places and nuclear in others, or aliens, or all kinds of things.
Yeah. But you know, I'll tell you the truth. I do have a natural preference, to pandemics. I prefer them as an act of nature, instead of some genetic engineering or aliens. You know, natural pandemic stories are like a callback to the old man versus nature theme.
Yeah.
And you know, viruses, bacteria, and fungi, they're the dominant life on the planet by any means that you measure it. And so I think sometimes we need to be reminded of that. And that's why I prefer them. I think this goes against the grain of our Anthropocene zeitgeist.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of conspiratorialists are really upset, but my opinion, human villains are are petty by comparison to what nature can do.
Yeah, yeah. So you're not a fan of the lab leak hypothesis. I was actually reading an article from Quillette this morning on basically the demise of the lab leak hypothesis and yet why it still endures.
Yeah, well, you know, I can tell you about lab leaks, lab accidents, at any rate.
Okay.
I had quite a few. But the main reason why I think that theory will endure is that nobody who ever worked in microbiology or virology is ever going to say, oh, that can't happen.
Right.
If you've worked in any period of time. So when I had a lab partner that got tuberculosis. Mm. And was working with a negative pressure hood and all that stuff, still managed to get it. Hmm.
A negative pressure hood is so you can't have anything exploding outwards.
Yeah, vacuums in. But they had not done the maintenance on the thing properly. And so when I started working with TB, we not only had the negative pressure hood, we had the gown, the gloves, face mask, everything. Because we take it very – TB is still the number one infectious disease killer out there. So. Hmm. You take it seriously. But then another one of my lab partners managed to get probably one of the worst cases of salmonella. Mm. And I myself had a rather nasty little accident right when I first started working there. I managed to flick a very large liquid globule of pure gonorrhea across my face and eyes.
Wow.
And let me tell you, industrial grade disinfectants, when you squirt it directly in your eye, mm-hmm. That really stinks, but it felt good at the time.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I ended up sleeping on the couch for a little while after that.
I was going to say, yeah, you're telling, no, honestly, honey, I got it at work.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's going to be really hard to explain. I had a vial of bloody HIV pleural fluid shatter in my bare hand.
Ooh.
It came out of a refrigerator and it probably was safe, but you know. But let me tell you, I got that glass off my hand very, very carefully.
Yeah.
Lab accidents do happen. It's just that the evidence on this one just seemed to all point to the market. And the reason China is squirming both ways, they don't want to admit to a lab accident, but they also don't want to admit to the fact that they had that wild meat market. They had promised to stop those after the first SARS epidemic, and they're embarrassed because they still had them. And they found the RNA from the COVID virus mixed in with raccoon dogs in the market. So they're samples that were collected before. So yeah, the theory will never go away, and that's sort of a problem with pandemic fiction too, because fiction is fiction. You want to tie up all the loose ends, and if you watch Contagion, the very end of that movie, you see the bat coming into the pigsty, and then you see the pig being slaughtered by the cook, and you see the cook go out and put his contaminated hands on patient zero. Mm. So you get a perfect picture. Well, you know, that just doesn't happen in real life. By the time that the pandemic's going on, the evidence is all faded. We're still arguing about, you know, a lot of great pandemics, where they started, even what diseases they were, some of the ones in history. So, well, that'll never go away. But, you know, like I said, nature has more than enough added. That's the simplest solution to about anything.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think the fact is we're talking about pandemic fiction in the era of COVID, right? So how do you think the COVID-19 pandemic that we've all lived through, how is that going to affect science fiction centered on pandemics going forward? Is it going to be, you know, is the subgenre gone? Or is it going to be just become better informed? Lots of science fiction set on other planets was informed by space exploration, planetary
exploration. And made obsolete as well.
Exactly. Like the planetary romances that had thriving civilizations on Venus and Mars and other planets, right?
Right, right.
Well, we know that's not true anymore. And even though it's too bad, you know, I love that kind of fiction, even though I know it's not accurate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was reading science fiction in the 60s when we had, you know, really thrillers about spaceships sinking into seas of dust on the moon. And so, it is like space travel. It's going to have to be better informed. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of terms now that the public knows. They know what an R value is. They know what super spreaders and fomites and aerosols.
And PCR
tests.
So
they're going to have and PCR tests. There's a lot. They know what a phase three trial is, you know. In the past, pandemic fiction was it was kind of the fiction of the unimaginable, a lot like a lot of other science fiction. But now it's not unimaginable. We've lived through it. So, it's going to have to be just a little bit more informed. You know, I liked How High We Can Go in the Dark, which, like I said, was written before the pandemic and only edited during it.
Right. But and let me point out one thing about that book, that it's essentially a COVID sort of thing, but the mortality is more limited to the very young. So more like the 1918 flu. And so it almost forces the world into like a Children of Men kind of time.
And it has
fertility, but
I have to say, I found reading it a lot of kind of magical realism more than science fiction. But one of the things it had in there that was just so hard for me to get over was the whole funeral based economy and the focus on the dead. Because all through history and during COVID, when you have large numbers of deaths, the bodies are treated horribly. They're dumped in mass graves. Even in New York City, they were dumping them in mass graves, and they're treated as unclean. So, you know, you remember, you may have seen, I don't know if you read obituaries very often, but during COVID, so many of the obituaries for people that died of COVID or didn't would say a memorial to be held at a later date.
Right.
And I have a friend in the funeral industry, and he said that never happened. I mean, he hadn't seen a single one of those. It's just, you know, the grief was too much. People just couldn't come back to it, and they moved on. And so in a way, you know, I understand why Nagamatsu?
Yeah.
I understand why he did it, but it's sort of like my first novel back in the 80s, you know, with the Soviets. It makes it hard to swallow after you've been through it and you know the way people really behave. Yeah.
And, you know, that novel kind of jumps over the, straight to the new normal or what the Phoenix economy called the new not normal.
Yeah. I wonder if he had a chapter about that and he just took it out.
Yeah, it could be.
Because, it could be.
Yeah. And, the euthanasia roller coasters and the euthanasia theme parks. It's a very sad book.
It is. But as a study of grief, I don't think you find too many that are better than that.
Yeah.
I mean, every aspect of grief is done. Whereas, you know, your standard pandemic novel just says, oh, and then everybody died. And now you got this, you know, a few people left moving on. So,
Yeah. You know, one of the things with COVID is it's easy to imagine that it could take away some of that horror and shock that we talk about the dawning realization. Instead, we're just going, oh, no, not this again.
Yeah. Yeah. Extra points if you're thinking about a bowl of petunias right now. Douglas Adams.
Yeah, I bet my friend Michael will get that one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But that's really what it's going to be, I think. So you're going to have to approach it. Another problem that might happen is that because so much about COVID has gotten polarized, certain subjects like vaccines, lockdowns, or even the CDC have gotten a political spin on them.
Yeah.
And so if you're writing a story about it, then you're going to suddenly find yourself alienating part of your audience.
Yeah.
And you don't know, you got to choose which one you're going to alienate depending on how you write it, you know? So
yeah, definitely.
I do think that people will be able to write them. They're just not going to be as simplistic. So one of the things about pandemics that I think everybody sees now is the real pandemics have a lot of infectious and demographic irregularities, and they cascade through society in ways that, you know, you just don't see coming. You don't see it coming quite as much. You certainly don't see the pandemic coming. COVID, you know, mostly affected the elderly.
Yeah.
And it created a kind of divide between the young and the old in how they viewed it. The 1918 flu was the reverse. But that was, like I said, it was during the middle of a war and news about it was censored. So the HIV, though, that set gay rights back decades.
Yeah.
And it changed the way people have sex, you know, so those are the kinds of things I think that authors probably will be looking at more. They're looking at taking advantage of public awareness of this kind of thing rather than just killing everybody off.
Yeah. So then, you know, HIV was a big thing in the 80s. Why didn't we see an effect of HIV on science fiction, pandemics, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you really would think it would have, because HIV was really a science fiction disease. You know, it killed everybody that got it.
Yeah.
And I think there's only one other infectious disease that I know of that does that, and that's rabies. And rabies, you know where that comes from. We went a long time without knowing what caused HIV.
Right.
And there were a bunch of different faces of this disease, you know, pneumocystis pneumonia and toxoplasma dementia and skin cancers. And what's really weird is even when we came up with a treatment, it was like a fairy tale. I mean, you had people that were dying. They were skeletons, barely able to move. And you gave them this drug and they popped right up. It was like the ending of a book where the author's rushing in to get everybody well so they can end it.
Right.
But for all that, it just didn't seem to change the way we looked at it. I think you could make the argument, because of all the blood aspects of AIDS, that vampire fiction became very popular. I think I've read other people trying to make that argument. It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But I think the real reason why HIV didn't change things as much was, like the 1918 flu, it was dampened. People did not want to admit that they had HIV. It was a marginalized population that had it. Mm-hmm. Even some of the families of victims of HIV they would make up what they died of.
Right.
So you never knew. It was kind of hidden.
Yeah, like Asimov, right?
Yeah, Asimov was a perfect example. He was very unfortunate in that he got a heart surgery in 1983, right at the period where we didn't know what caused it. We didn't have a test for it. And he had a heart operation and got a blood transfusion. And 9 years later, he died of AIDS. And his family, he didn't let on that was what was causing it. He continued to blame it on his heart. And 10 years after he died, when the family released his autobiography, they finally admitted it. I didn't hear about it till 5 years after that.
Yeah, I didn't. When we were talking about this on the on the email thread, that's when I learned about it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this will go, wait a minute, and they'll go run into Google to find out if it's true. basically, because it had all that suppression, I think it kept news down. But COVID is a little bit different. COVID was in our faces.
Yeah.
It was public. It was just no way we were going to avoid it. And I just, it doesn't have any shortage of controversies or debates about it. But I think it's going to be very hard to dislodge from the public consciousness.
Yeah. What would you say are the biggest differences between COVID, you know, something that we've recently gone through, and pandemics typically presented in science fiction?
Yeah. The big one is the body count. Most pandemics go for the really big body count. But COVID was right at the lower limit of the mortality rate that causes people to get really upset.
Yeah.
It did show us, though, that even at that level, people can panic. And it showed us just how well the world behaves during a global threat.
Yeah, not well.
Yeah, not well at all. Now we know that you don't need 90% of the population to make society collapse. I mean, I personally think that a really bad smallpox virus with maybe 10 to 20% mortality, which is reasonable for smallpox, that would probably send us back to the 1800s or further. I think really what COVID really showed, which I'm sure will affect science fiction as well, is that we live in a technological house of cards.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take much to bring it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because it kind of sat in that place where our level of technology allowed us to kind of keep going during COVID, but just a little more mortality and some of the infrastructure starts to fail and it could get bad.
Yeah. I mean, if it had been a little less fatal, we probably would have ignored it. If it had been just a little bit more fatal, I think we really would have been in trouble. Or maybe we wouldn't have. Maybe it would have been so bad that people would have paid it a lot more attention and shut down a little faster.
Yeah. So was COVID different from previous pandemics and any other ways that will affect science fiction in the future?
Yeah, I think the big one for me, as someone who worked a long time ago in microbiology, was the medical science and the technology. They were just radically different from what we had. HIV was played out with very crude virology tools. There was no genetic testing. There were almost no antivirals.
Yeah.
This is the thing that a lot of people forget about. From the time the first AIDS cases were reported in a cheery little periodical called Morbidity and Mortality, I actually read that. From that time to the time we actually knew what it was, that it was a virus and it was spread in certain ways, that was 3 years.
Yeah.
Now think about that for a minute. So it's been just a little over 3 years since COVID started.
Yeah.
So imagine going through all that we've gone through and just now we're finding out what it is.
Right.
You know, it's a virus. Oh, it's a virus. And it's this kind of virus. And that's the virus. That was what AIDS was like.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of doomed and we were kind of stupid, doomed and ignorant. I think the Doomsday Book, the medieval plague part, really captured that well, just helplessness.
This is a judgment from God, right? What else could
happen? Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And, with COVID, we had the full genetic sequence in weeks.
Yeah.
And I remember your Doomsday Book episode that you did a podcast.
Yeah.
And which I think I give you, you're very brave to do that in the middle of the pandemic. that was quite something.
Yeah.
But, you and your co-host, y'all doubted, y'all questioned how fast things
were. Right. Yeah. Rebecca saying something what is this utopian future they're talking about here? We're gonna get this all wrapped up in weeks.
Yeah, well, it was a little fast, but it was 2054. But I'll tell you the truth. From my out-of-date microbiology perspective, it sounded just like COVID. I mean, it moved lightning quick, which is what COVID seemed like to me. I mean, we had the genetic sequence real quick. We had a candidate vaccine within a month and we spent the rest of our time testing it and we tested it in record time. I mean, the previous virus vaccine to ever get approved took 4 years. This took like 11 months or something. And so, you may have heard another influence of AIDS in science fiction. I heard when the Hugo girls were getting ready to do their podcast on that book, I wrote in and said, can you correct just one little mistake? And I was talking about, and I'll mention that later, but I did point out to them that book was written during AIDS. And so that sense of doom, that really was really in keeping with the time that it was written around AIDS. You had the medical helplessness, that we had even during AIDS, certainly during the 1918 flu. I think after COVID, pandemic fiction will probably rely less on technological limitations and more on human foolishness, which COVID spotlighted very well.
Thinking of a movie like Don't Look Up, right? There's an obvious allegory in there for denial of climate change, but you can very easily see that with the response to COVID as well.
I don't think it would have resonated or been as popular if it had been released before COVID.
Yeah. I didn't think it was very good. I thought it was super on the nose, but it was interesting.
Yeah. It was very meant to be over the top and it definitely
worked. It succeeded. So, you know, we talked about the lab leak theory and saying basically, if you're, unless you're a conspiracy theorist, right, the COVID is very likely a natural disease. But what about pandemic stories that rely on unnatural origins?
Yeah. So, like I said, those are my favorite types. But a good number start with unnatural origins, such as an Andromeda strain. And, and others have fantasy elements where they get by. They don't have to worry about the science at all.
Sure.
But I do think that we probably will see more of those because and less of where nature's to blame because, you know, people want somebody to blame, you know. And also authors may use genetic manipulation or aliens to get around some of the scientific limitations that now people are aware of.
Right. More broader awareness of the natural stuff. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. So yeah, that may be a dodge that people use. Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a little bit about things that pandemic fiction gets wrong. Let's talk about what they get right.
Yeah. So I think the big thing they get right is the confusion and the panic. Mm. I mean, it's an obvious one, but it needs to be said. Once we recognize a new disease, what they called a novel virus, and that's an important point because when you say novel, that means we don't really know what it's going to do because we've never seen it before. And there's this feeling of being behind the curve, and it makes for an exciting story. There's one trope that is both right and wrong that I feel like I ought to mention, and that's in a lot of pandemic stories, there's always one guy. Usually it's a guy, could be a woman as well, who knows what's going on.
Right.
He's right and everybody's wrong. And if only we'd listened to him, everything would have been so much better. And he's usually fighting to save the world. Well, the truth is, in a real pandemic, there are 100 such people, men and women. But the problem is they're all saying different things. Mm. One says this, one says that. And what happens is, once the pandemic is finally solved, people figure out what it is. They forget about the other 99 and they remember that one person and go, if only we listen to him.
Right.
it's the survivor bias personified.
Yeah.
Same thing happens after a stock market crash. There's always somebody that makes their career by saying, I predicted that was going to happen.
Right, right. And then they never predict anything right again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's, you know, your performance may vary. You know,
so. Exactly. That's why they always say that because it's been studied pretty well that these people who make one big right prediction, it's not because they were just smarter. They got lucky on that one.
Yeah, yeah. And you look at Connie Willis's the modern pandemic that she had. Mm-hmm. They had that was amazingly accurate.
I know from the 90s, like toilet paper shortages, right?
Yeah, toilet paper shortages, lockdowns, first and secondary exposure searches, xenophobia, rapid gene sequencing.
Masking.
Masking, I think most people could predict, but I don't know how many people would have thought of toilet paper right off the bat. But that's really good.
I know that in different parts of the world, right, people as a courtesy, if they're sick, will often wear a mask, right? But that's not something that I think is super common in the U.S. I think that's why there was such a resistance.
There was attempts to get people to mask during the 1918 flu, and there was opposition to it. There was a mask opposition society, people really, it's just... she did miss some things. I mean, she obviously didn't have texting and Zoom she would her, and I have to say her modern disease was an epidemic, not a pandemic, apparently.
Right.
Yeah. But, and it was in Oxford. It wasn't in red state America. So, probably some of the things didn't have it. There was one scientific flub in there and that was the one that I wrote to, Hugo Girls about, which is, it was obviously done for artistic reasons, was that the modern epidemic came from graves of the medieval times. That ain't going to happen. I mean, viruses decay, break down very quickly, unless you're in like maybe permafrost. Mm. But If that wasn't happening, then archaeologists would be dropping dead like flies. So
right.
Yeah. So, but you know, that was a minor point. But it sort of points to get back to what we're talking about. The debate over origins of a pandemic are endless because, you know, people mess with it. So.
Yeah. I mean, it was the origin of it was in Oxford, but they were still calling it the Indian flu.
Yeah. Yes. That's right. That's
yeah. It. So, okay, you know, you worked in infectious disease, so what are some pet peeves? What bugs you the most? the inaccuracies in a pandemic story that bug you the most?
Well, yeah, the biggest one beyond the pale is the bugs are always too deadly, too fast, and too contagious, all at the same time. You know, right. You can have one, but you can't have all three. You know, that doesn't happen. And, you know, for instance, you know, respiratory aerosols, which is the way a lot of them are spread, they contain a very small number of viruses.
Yeah.
So you get some of those small number of viruses in, it takes a while for that to replicate in your body to the point where you actually get sick. That's what an incubation period is.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you have direct contact bugs like Ebola and AIDS, you know, that still, those incubation periods are long. So you just can't get them all at once.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at, if you watch Outbreak, that movie with horrible science, that virus acts like nerve gas more than it does anything else. Yeah. And you know, this is true, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but in 2014, I don't know if you remember the Ebola scare.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an Ebola outbreak in Africa, and a nurse or two came back infected to the United States, and people just lost their minds. And I was trying to calm some people down because I knew enough about Ebola to know that it was not going to spread. In Africa, a lot of people take care of their own dead, and that was how they were getting it. And it just wasn't going to spread that way. So I made this bet with somebody trying to convince them. I said, I'll give you $1 for every case over 100 that in the United States, and you'll give me $1 for every case under 100. Mm-hmm. This guy was like, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. That's an unlimited bet. I said, I feel safe. And I won $89 on that, but he never paid up, which is probably good.
It's kind of a morbid bet.
it was a morbid bet. I'd be embarrassed to have made money off that.
Yeah. I mean, that's something about the, you know, pandemic fiction kind of amps us up to think about the worst case, right? With something like Ebola.
Yeah. They, you know, it's a novel. You're going to make the worst you can get. Station 11 is a good example of this. The author admitted that the pandemic was just a method to get to post-technological society. And so she made that bug just move like lightning through town. You know, people were trying to outrun it, and it was that fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I already said the movie Outbreak was even worse, but it did have a line. I think it was Dustin Hoffman who said, fear gets a bad rap, because, you know, that's basically what limits really highly contagious, highly deadly bugs is people get afraid and they isolate. And, you know, the problem that we learned from COVID is that people have different fear thresholds. You know, it's a 1 in 100 sounds good to some people. 1 in 100 is an awful virus.
Mm-hmm.
If 1 in 100 people die, that's bad. And that, and the beginning days of COVID, it was around 1 in 100 or sometimes 3 in 100. Now, maybe if you had a respiratory spread Ebola-like hemorrhagic fever, even the most freedom-loving anti-masker would probably see some wisdom in staying home that day. So I want to say, you know, it'd be foolish to say this can never happen. But it's just, there's a lot of evolutionary dynamics and epidemiology that just work against it. So I'm not as worried about those kinds.
You know, you talked about the kind of the three factors there, right? Too fast, too deadly, too contagious. Is it just that if something that is that deadly, you can quarantine and it's effective, people who get it die off and then don't spread it?
Yeah, well, first off, you die really fast. You're obviously not going to spread it much anymore unless somebody handles your body. But also, you know, when something really bad like that happens, people who can isolate. And right. you're not going to get the bug, you know, from people driving by your house. You right. know, so, you know, people shut down. And that's really what's limits. Every pandemic has a curve where people are not behaving, and then they start behaving and it levels out, and then natural immunity kicks in. Even HIV had that, you know, people began changing their behaviors because they were scared. You mm-hmm. know, that's the way it worked.
So are there any insights to be gained from pandemic fiction, movies, books, you know, for the general public? Or is it just, just grim entertainment?
It is grim entertainment, that's for sure. Movies do seem to have an effect on public consciousness. I heard the movie Contagion cited many times during COVID. You probably did too. And I also heard Outbreak discussed, which kind of depressed me. But one thing, Andromeda Strain, this is just my perception, but I accuse the Andromeda Strain of promulgating that belief that, oh, it'll just mutate into harmlessness. Like I said, that's just an illusion created by immunity. So, I think we mentioned in the Felix Salmon book, Phoenix Economy, he mentioned that the Douglas Adams joke that he mentioned was talking about the extinction of the Galgafrinchum. You may remember that they're the ones that got wiped out by a disease spread by a dirty telephone after they had banned all their telephone sanitizers to another planet.
Right.
And what Felix Salmon pointed out was that this kind of pointed towards a theme that happened in real life and happened in many pandemic novels, which is the lowly worker becomes elevated in importance. So you have nurses and Grubhub drivers and grocery store clerks suddenly become essential workers, and everybody honors them for taking a chance so the rest of us can eat and be taken care of.
Yeah.
And in World War Z, they had the similar thing where, you know, humble skills, farming and sewing and carpentry are lifted up while movie stars and influencers are just considered worthless.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there's another thing which I've been thinking about as we were going over this is the pandemic fiction oftentimes is trying to show us the heightened capacity for good and evil. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you think of the selfless priest in the Doomsday Book.
Yeah.
Or the evil prophet in Station 11. And it does make for good reading. But if you're classically middle class, you may find them kind of like a caricature and find it kind of unbelievable. But once you've lived through a major crisis like that, you start to realize, hey, people really do that. You know, they really do. Some of them are heroes and some of them are really, really sink low. The capacity for going low and going high is pretty, pretty exaggerated. I can tell you personally that during AIDS, I lost a lot of naivete because I heard people that I believed in and respected say some god-awful, incorrect and harmful things that because of my job, I knew weren't true. And I really wish I had learned that from fiction than from real life.
Yeah.
I mean, it started a lot of me questioning a lot of the things that I had believed in up to that point.
Yeah. So looking forward with the subgenre of pandemic fiction and science fiction, where do you think that it can go?
I think the wild array of effects that that Felix Salmon's Phoenix Economy put out there could be kind of a map for authors. You know, they might consider how society might change even when a small percentage of people are sick or die. And like I said, John Scalzi's Lock-In, which, you know, was predicated on this book. It was predicated on a pandemic where it was like a flu, but 1% of the people, their brain was totally cut off from their body and they're locked in, the lock-in syndrome. And so he created this whole virtual technology that became the setting of the book. It's basically a murder mystery with that. And like I said earlier, that's really reminiscent of Zoom and virtual technologies like the call we're on right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of dynamic that writers could take. One of the ones I wish they would do is I wish somebody would write a pandemic novel where instead of minorities or the put upon poor are the victims or the old people. Certainly I want old people to fare better. Mm-hmm. Instead, make the rich and powerful the people that really get sick. I think that would make for an interesting reversal in the dynamics of a typical science pandemic story. So I think there are a lot of things they can play with. They're just not going to be able to go for kill everybody unless have mm-hmm. gunfights with roving bandits.
Did you happen to see the movie Triangle of Sadness?
No, I don't think I have.
It almost does that. It's not with a pandemic. It's just a shipwreck where all these rich and powerful, these influencers and rich blue bloods end up shipwrecked on this island, and one of the servant class people on the ship, one of the worker class people on the ship, with her skills, she's able to provide food and make fires and that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden she becomes in charge. So it's a reversal of roles because of that. And of course, the rich people object to it because they're like, well, why should you be in charge? And she's like, I made the fire. I caught the fish. I'm feeding you. I'm in charge.
Yeah, that would be fun. I think I'd enjoy that. It's called Triangle of Sadness.
Yeah. It's a strange movie. But I definitely
want to do that. Mm-hmm. You and I were exchanging The Last of Us.
Yeah.
Which I haven't played the game or watched the movie, but I think using a fungal pandemic is genius because mm-hmm. I can tell you from working in microbiology, I was never more scared was when I was working with a fungal pathogen. Mm. I mean, they the fuzzy fungi can leap off the plate with their spores.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also there just were so few treatments. There really still are very few treatments for fungal.
Yeah. And they talk about that in the Last of Us series, but also if you want to read a book about it, The Girl with All the Gifts by Mike Carey is another fungal fiction one.
Yeah.
That's very good.
I think given the lack of information about them and the lack of antifungals, who knows? Fungi are the new viruses. So.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. The very beginning of The Last of Us, it starts with a news program, a commentary program, where someone is opining that a fungal vector could be much worse than viruses. And somebody else objects, well, no, fungi can't survive in our body temperatures. And he said, well, not right now, but let's say the Earth were to get a little bit warmer. And it would become an adaptive trait, right?
Yes. And the people are actually seeing that at the CDC. They recently released an alert about a fungus called Candida auris, which I don't.
The yeast, isn't it?
It's been too long. It's, well, yeast are fungi. I think it's already starting to happen. Mm. And it could, and I think I've read there's a fungal pneumonia out in the West, in the desert, spread by the spores. Its name eludes me at the moment, but that's starting to pick up and become more prevalent. Mm. So yeah, just same story with a different villain.
Yeah. We've mentioned a number of titles throughout the podcast, but let's go ahead and circle kind of back to that about reading recommendations for pandemic fiction.
Well, my number one would be Doomsday Book.
Okay.
I do think that's the best.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's two pandemic novels in one. So you get double your money.
Yeah. Yeah. And Connie Willis does such a good job with characters too, that it pulls you really into their plight. And so when characters start dying, it really affects you.
Yeah. She is really good at that. And, I like her for a lot of her humorous writings, but I was just very impressed with just how she took a really serious one and really bore in on it.
Mm-hmm. How High We Go in the Dark is one that we've talked about a couple times. We talked about the fact that it's a pandemic that affects the young. I think the prose is excellent. It's really just a series of interconnected short stories. It's not a novel per se, mm-hmm. But one story will build on the other. You might see events referenced or characters that repeat.
Yeah, there was one pseudo afterlife chapter that was tied in later, and I thought that was very, very effective.
Yeah, that was good. We mentioned the Andromeda Strain, which I will say we have an episode on that for Take Me to Your Reader if people want to check that out. We also did an interview with Daniel H. Wilson, who is author of The Andromeda Evolution, which is a kind of a legacy sequel for the Andromeda Strain, which was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. He lives in Portland, so we went over and interviewed him in person. World War Z is another one.
Yeah, World War Z, I think that's an underappreciated book.
Yeah.
I mean, and I would warn anybody that saw the movie, it's very different.
Very different.
The book is very different from the movie.
And that's another one we covered on our podcast. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the original screenplay for World War Z that was not shot, that you can find. It was written by J. Michael Straczynski, and it's excellent.
Ah, I didn't know that was out there. So.
Yeah.
So you know, Station 11, Emily St. John Mandel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just recently listened to that one. That's very good.
Yeah, I just think that's probably, of all the books we're talking about, I think that's one of the most moving and I don't want to say artistic because that demeans it a little bit, but it's just very rich.
Yeah, I mean, there's that repeated mantra, right, that to survive is not enough or to live is not enough. I don't remember.
I
remember things differently when I read them in print and when I listen to them on audio.
And I really, I don't know why it moved me more, but having the unifying part of the book be a character who died before the pandemic, literally just before that. I don't know, that created a hook for me that made it much more enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah. We also talked about The Earth Abides.
Yeah. Dated and
It's a little long.
Yeah, it is. But one thing about Earth Abides that I liked is because, you know, the novel part was the buildings were still standing. He had this juxtaposition where he was trying to teach the next generation to read while the library was still there, and he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Society was going down, and there was nothing he could do to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was, I think it was, as a commentary, it was excellent.
Yeah. So. It's interesting, too, the pandemic tie-in, it's not pandemic, it's just, you know, civilization falls, you're going to have some disease, right? And that mm-hmm. affects them, because he does have the one child who he thinks will be the one to take on his legacy and continue to learn and teach. Unfortunately,
he dies of disease of
measles,
strep or something.
Yeah.
Measles or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, which we're starting to see, even without collapse of society, we're starting to see some of these bugs come back.
You know,
we're seeing polio. I heard a case of malaria popped up in Maryland. So we've got it all in Texas, Florida, and Maryland. So yeah, it's not hard to imagine, you know, that kind of setback. You know?
Yeah. I was talking to my mom once about, you know, remembering things like the polio vaccine, right? The development of the polio vaccine. And when you knew people affected by the virus who died of it, and then you got to take a vaccine to keep you from getting it, then, you know, that makes you think vaccine's very, very good. And then you fast forward 20, 30 years where nobody has ever seen anyone with polio. And then they start going, well, what about autism? You know, you know, and you start getting the anti-vax kind of thing moving in because people have moved far enough away from remembering what it was like.
They forget.
Before the vaccine.
They forget.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had the two earliest stories my grandmother and my mother told me. My grandmother had a childhood memory of the 1918 flu pandemic. She was in Richmond, and she saw a flatbed rail car stacked, cross-hatched coffins stacked three or four high.
Dang.
And then my mother was pregnant with me when the polio vaccine was coming out.
Mm.
And so she told me over and over again how happy she was that she was not going to have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, people forget, and they don't. You know, one of the worst days I remember at the hospital, I was working on a Sunday morning, and Sunday morning, usually the pediatric infectious disease docs would come in because they have such a short leash with children that they would come in and ask us to read the cultures ahead of time and give us our best guesses. And it's a very nice guy, that doctor that I really liked. And he came in that day, and he just looked like he was going to die. He was depressed. He was all but crying. And I asked him what happened, and he had just sat all night with a child dying of whooping cough, which is easily preventable with a vaccine. And apparently, dying of whooping cough is probably one of the most painful ways to die on the planet. And so, my children were very young, and I went home and I said, we're getting every vaccine that is possible, you know, because I think maybe we're going to have to go back to have a couple childhood outbreaks before we finally get back to it. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. But you still, you know, you have people on the internet saying, well, you just need sunshine and fresh air. And like, tell that to people who live in slums, you know, that's all they need. Oh, well, in that case, I will just not live here anymore.
Yeah. Well, the other, when you, all you need is this, we oftentimes saw people, I'm going to cure my cancer with, with good food, and I'm going to quit eating the things. I'm going to quit smoking finally, a little late, but you know, usually those people, once the tumor got big enough, they'd say, okay, let me try some of them chemicals, you know, and it's a sad case, but it's true.
Sorry. So we were talking about titles and got sidetracked.
Yeah. That's what happens. Yeah. I think the next one on the list was Odd Billy Todd, which is basically, like I said, a prepper wish fulfillment fantasy novel.
And that's relatively recent, isn't it?
I read it a while ago. I don't know when it was.
Looks like 2015. Yeah.
Oh, that's what happens when you retire.
It's kind of an old timey sounding book title, I have to say.
Yes, it is. And it's not bad. It's a little repetitive, but it's got all the memes of pandemic fiction. It would be a good audiobook if you're traveling a long distance.
Nice. Yeah,
so then we talked about The Phoenix Economy, which, you know, like I said, it's worth just the introduction, but I read the whole thing and I found many parts of it just utterly fascinating. When he started talking about people not wearing their seat belts, I flipped out because I had to admit to my sister I was wrong, because it was in the height of the pandemic. I said, well, at least the roads are safe because nobody's driving. And she said, Bob, the road deaths are going up. And I said, no way. And I went on to Google and damn, it wasn't true. I mean, it's like people were, you know, they were dealing with one risk. So they would just say, okay, well, I'm just going to let it all hang out. And
right.
Yeah. So I can't complain. I have a bad history of risk. You see that picture behind me?
Mm-hmm. Skydiving.
I used to skydive, and unfortunately my brother did too, and he died doing it. So risk is real. I mean, you know, you have to take it seriously.
Yeah.
I found that an excellent map. And then we talked about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which anybody that's read the book but hasn't listen to the original radio series should definitely do that.
Yeah, that is the better way to experience it.
It really is.
And that's an interesting case of a book being adapted from the radio play.
Yes.
People don't understand that. They don't know that the radio play was the first thing.
Yes. I would say the first two seasons of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is just some of the best listening you can find. Yeah. BBC really knew what they were doing.
I strongly prefer the radio play. And reading it in print, I don't love it. So just somehow the humor works better when it's said by British people.
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Let's see. Lock In.
Mm-hmm.
They're detective novels. I'm not really that much of a fan of science fictions that are really mystery novels. But I did find that one interesting because of the various things he did. Outbreak. I just, you know, it got the blood from one little monkey is going to save a whole town. I mean, come on, people. I know it's Hollywood, but still.
Yeah.
Contagion. Well,
and I think don't they come up with whatever treatment they have? And Rene Russo's been sick for a day or two already, and they, you know, they give it to her, and she's 100% recovered. You know, she wouldn't have liver failure or multi-organ failure by then. With a hemorrhagic fever, that would be very bad.
Yeah, that would be bad. Now Contagion, again, it wraps things up in a little bow, but it's you have to give it nods. It has scientists acting badly. It has a major character.
Yeah.
bank one star, dying.
That's gut punch in that movie.
Yeah. And that's real life. I mean, you know, when you say 1 in 100 or 1 in 10 are going to die, it isn't, except for the main characters. You know, you got to have, you know, it's sort of Game of Thrones like.
Yeah, some of that reminds me of the Chernobyl series that was on HBO, where at some point the two main characters are talking to each other, and you know, one of them's a politician, one's a scientist, and the scientist is saying, "We need to get everyone away from here." Because people are going to die because of this, and they cannot stay here. And the politician says, "Well, we're staying here." And the other one says, "Yes, and we'll be dead in 5 years." And you can just see the dawning realization on the Stellan Skarsgård character that, oh, I didn't realize that. You know, the reality just drops like an anvil.
Yes, and
it's very good.
Yeah, that was pretty good. And we talked about The Last of Us. Mm-hmm. I don't think he did, but since we haven't seen it, we can't say it's much.
No. I've watched the show. The show is excellent.
Oh, you did?
I never played the game, but yeah, I've watched it, and it's excellent. And it really does start well with that dawning realization. There's a moment when someone, I think in Indonesia or Indonesia, she realizes what's happening, and she says, "You need to order a bombing strike on the city immediately."
They did that in Contagion as well.
Yeah. And then she asks, "Can someone please drive me home? I'd like to be with my family."
Yeah. And I will say, after COVID, that becomes less believable, because the idea of people getting that realization and being that aware of what's going on enough to make a harsh decision like that.
Yeah.
That's just not believable, because people will always try to talk themselves out of it. I mean, you'll hear it if you listen to almost any of the early reporting with virologists, and I did it too. I underestimated what was going on. And the reason is because it's, you know, if you're dealing with a 1 in 100 year event, it's always safe to bet against it. There's always a reason why it isn't going to happen until it actually does.
Right. Well, and then you get people constantly talking about, well, what about, you know, They had comorbidities, right? You're like, yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. I have an uncle who's, you know, nearing 90 and was a lifelong smoker. I still don't want him to die earlier than he has to.
Right. Well, you know, that's something that, and I'm again confessing something that is true of most people that work in hospitals, and certainly was true for me as a in microbiology, is that that's the way you defend yourself. Against you're working with this stuff, you know, you're actually, I had small children and I saw a dead baby in the autopsy room. You know, the way you defend your mind against that is by chipping away at create a distance between you and that patient. Yeah. So when I would have we'd have a patient that was dying of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, a tick-borne disease, you know, I would ask the infectious disease doc, "How long did they wait till they went to the emergency room?" And they said, "Oh, they waited too long." And I go, "Oh, well, then I'm safe, because I would not do that." Right. But in real life, it's just different. You know, in real life, you can find 5 reasons why not to go to the emergency room.
Sure.
Nowadays, you can find a lot more. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you create this gulf between you and the victim by identifying things about them that are different. So,
yeah,
you know, the moment they started saying COVID was striking minorities more, I knew a bunch of people, "Oh, well, then I'm safe. I'm not a minority."
Yeah.
You know, it's the problem of large numbers and probabilities. People don't really grasp.
Yeah. And with AIDS too, right? It's IV drug users and gay men. I'm not one of those people.
Yes. And yet this is true. The AIDS epidemic is still going on.
Yeah.
People are getting it all the time. It's just we have a way to treat it.
It's more controlled now. Yeah.
You want to take a bunch of pills every day for the rest of your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've
heard that there's some prospect of an mRNA vaccine for HIV.
Yeah. They've got one in the works that I've heard, but I don't know how, you know, successful it'll be. That's another thing about COVID. We're very spoiled by COVID.
Yeah.
Nobody that I knew expected a vaccine to be that effective. Mm-hmm. When somebody comes out with an AIDS vaccine that is 50 or 60% effective instead of 90%, A lot of people are going to be very disappointed, but you know what? As many people in particularly in third world countries that are still dying of AIDS, man, that would be fantastic. A malaria vaccine that was that good.
Yeah.
If you could reduce malaria deaths by 50%, it'd just be enormously helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. There's a good segment of the listeners of this conversation that will think that vaccine wasn't effective. What are you talking about? Because that's what their pundits are telling them.
Yeah. Well, I told when I was unblinded and got the real vaccine when I was on the Moderna trial, I told him, I said, I hope you realize that your vaccine is probably more effective than your numbers are telling you. Mm. And they said, why? And I said, because you did this in such a hurry. You gave for the placebo, you just gave us saline. Mm-hmm. If you were doing a real study, you would have given us another vaccine, say a flu shot.
Right.
Because a flu shot makes your arm sore and the flu shot has some effects. Mm-hmm. And I knew the moment I got the shot that I'd gotten a placebo. And because of that, I said, I'm still going to be really, really careful. Meanwhile, my neighbor who got on it the same way, she had her arms got all red and she felt crappy for days. She had probably one of the more extensive reactions I've ever seen. Mm. But she went out there going, well, I definitely am vaccinated.
So I'm invincible now.
Yeah. And so I said, that's going to mean that, you know, because we all knew what we were on, it's going to make the vaccine look worse than it really is. And you still got 90%. So it's really, you know, the whole point of the vaccine, that was also lost. And I knew it because I had to sign all these consent forms, that the point of the vaccine wasn't to make you not get the bug. It was to make it so you didn't get hospitalized.
Right.
And that was all they were measuring. They said, because they couldn't, that trial, they couldn't actually tell unless you got physically sick and got tested. They didn't know whether you got it. All they were watching was, do you end up at the doctor or the hospital?
Yeah.
Sick. And so, so a lot of things like COVID that are COVID specific may affect the way people write fiction that probably aren't valid. Some mm-hmm. that are valid and some that aren't. So,
Right. Well, I think, let's see, when did Heinlein write Stranger in a Strange Land, right? Which has a civilization on Mars well after we mm-hmm. pretty much knew Mars. No, there's nothing there. So. You can still.
That was my favorite Heinlein book. Yes.
It's a weird one.
But yeah, I love that one. That really was. Nice. A lot of his books I did not like, but I really loved that one.
Yeah. Well, I think we've come to the end of our topics. So Bob, I really want to thank you for reaching out, you know, all those months ago and flooding my inbox and with the.
Well, with I'm a writer, so I write these things down. So
And I finally, at some point I had to say, like, I've been so busy trying to wrap up Hugo's There 1.0 and get stuff ready for the next phase. Plus work was terribly busy. And so like, I will respond, just give me a little bit of time. This was great. And I don't know how much of a model this will be for other subgenres, just because I don't know. I think anytime you zoom in on a subgenre, you realize that it's a subgenre of subgenres and you can go lots of different ways from inside it.
And this is unusual in that you have a subgenre that has recently had a concurrent reality event.
Exactly.
So maybe if the aliens come next year, you can do another one on first contact novels.
There we go. Yeah.
That'll be your follow up. You know?
Yes. Maybe I'll be the one chosen to go and sit on the other side of the screen from Childhood's End and talk to, I had his name, the main overlord. I can't remember his name now. It's a great book.
I can't either.
Cool. Well, so Bob, if people want to reach out to you, can they find you anywhere online?
I have a diminishing presence on Twitter. Wallet55 is my handle as a reference to what I viewed my purpose in life as a parent back in the day when I first joined. But I'm growing on Mastodon. I do wallet55 at toot.site. I'm hoping that more people will go over there. So yeah, that's about it.
Awesome. Well, so listener, I want to invite you to talk back and say, do you have favorite pandemic fiction that you want to recommend? Anything that we missed? Please chime in. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Bob. I thought that was really great. That's the first of my zoomed out subgenre spotlight episodes. I have a lot of these planned. If you think that you're the right person to talk about a subgenre, do reach out to me. I have these planned for military science fiction. I have one planned for horror as well as a, you know, sort of as a subgenre of genre fiction. I have some other ones as well. But if you want to reach out and volunteer for one of these, the wait time for any guest at this point is longer than it typically was for Hugo's There in the past. And it's kind of in two different ways. I'm already planned out well through next year for guests, and then I'm running a backlog as well. And so, you know, I've recorded this episode with Bob in August of 2023. It's probably not going to come out till December. So unless I make changes to my schedule. So just letting you know, there is a pretty good wait, but I'd still love to have you get your foot in the door and get you on the list. Okay. As always, you can support this podcast by sharing it with your friends on whatever social media sites you're on. I did just sign up for Blue Sky. My handle there is just S. Heasley. I don't know why I just didn't do Hugo's podcast again, but I decided to sign up as myself instead of this as the podcast. And if you want to add any financial support to the podcast, you can do that through an ongoing payment at patreon.com/Hugo's podcast. Or if you want to be a person like Bob, actually, who wanted to support but wanted to be able to do a one-time payment kind of thing, I set up Buy Me a Coffee. So buymeacoffee.com/SethHeaselD. And I, as always, I will have those links in the show notes for the podcast. Do also make sure, you know, in an episode like this, there's going to be a bunch of reading recommendations. I'll capture those in the show notes as well. And, you know, let us know what you think of the suggestions and if you have any others. Okay, I think that's going to do it for this episode. And so I'll talk to you next time with more of a regular kind of episode. All right, bye now. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.